are listening to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News.
Good afternoon. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins podcasting to you from the coast of California on this beautiful day, May 21, 2016. I've had a number of inquiries lately through clinic and also through our Facebook site about hyperprolactinemia, infertility, and then also prolactinomas in pregnancy. So I've been motivated to do a podcast on some of those issues to share some of my thoughts. Joining me in this dialogue today is Mr. Jorge Fascinetti, whom you all know. Jorge, welcome.
Well, hello, and hello to all our listeners. Always good to get together for these fascinating topics. I know our listeners find these very informational, and I'm always looking forward to learning more about these great topics. Our listeners, I think, especially women and couples, will appreciate this information very much. So, the mic is all yours.
All right, let's get started. First, some physiology. Prolactin is produced by the prolactin-producing cells known as the lactotrophs in the anterior pituitary gland. Prolactin production by the pituitary gland is rather complex, and it's under the regulation of several different influences. There are prolactin-releasing factors, and the two most commonly known ones are vasoactive intestinal peptide and thyrotropin-releasing hormone. Thyrotropin-releasing hormone, or TRH, being the hypothalamic hormone that actually leads to TSH secretion by the anterior pituitary gland. The principal influence over prolactin secretion, however, is a negative one, and that is via dopamine produced by the hypothalamus and transported down the pituitary stalk to the prolactin-producing cells, and dopamine inhibits prolactin secretion. In fact, it's this inhibitory function of dopamine that allows us to use dopamine agonist drugs like bromocriptine and cabergoline to treat hyperprolactinemia. There are a number of central nervous system factors and reflex arcs that influence prolactin secretion. We think of prolactin as a stress hormone, for example, so pathways that activate the autonomic nervous system and recognition of stress through cognitive aspects probably lead to prolactin release. It's involved in the immune system responses. Reflex arcs that affect the chest wall can lead to prolactin secretion. For example, if someone has shingles or a chest wall injury, or the simple act of breastfeeding actually leads to prolactin secretion so that there can be milk let down in response to that suckling.
This is all very interesting and, as all things in endocrinology, complicated. What does prolactin do?
Fair enough. Once prolactin is secreted into the circulation, it finds its receptors and binds to them and initiates a number of things within the cells that have prolactin receptors. And generally speaking, we think of prolactin as being important for breastfeeding. So it sort of primes the breast to make milk in conjunction with about 5 to 6 other hormones, and then leads to milk letdown when prolactin levels spike as a consequence of nipple stimulation. As mentioned, prolactin probably also does things that are involved in immune system regulation and may play a role in hypothalamic sensing of body weight and weight management. And we do know that it affects the hypothalamus in that it does interfere with the pulsatility of gonadotropin-releasing hormone from the hypothalamus that stimulates LH and FSH, which then regulates ovarian function in women and testicular function in men.
Well, that makes sense, and that explains why women with hyperprolactinemia often get galactorrhea, which is excessive milk production, and then have various issues with their menstrual periods.
Yes, Jorge, that's very precise. In fact, the menstrual abnormalities in women can range from amenorrhea to simply irregular menses, lack of ovulation with breakthrough bleeding on occasion, or even a simple luteal phase defect in the presence of ovulation, and then again infertility with what seems to be normal but slightly irregular menses.
And what about the absolute value or the sensitivity of the prolactinemia? Is that predictive of the clinical effect on the patient?
Good question. In my experience, it's not. I see some patients who have prolactin levels in the 30s to 40s and they're amenorrheic, and other patients with prolactin levels at 120 who are able to achieve pregnancy. So generally speaking, when your prolactin levels are significantly elevated, there is a correlation, but in that range of patients who have mild to modest elevations of prolactin, there's so much individual variation in biology that we can see all sorts of symptoms and signs correlated with prolactin levels or not.
You mentioned luteal phase defect. What is that?
A luteal phase defect is an abnormality in the luteal phase of the menstrual cycle. Basically, the follicular phase, or first phase of the menstrual cycle, is related to the follicles producing estrogens, and then after ovulation, the hole where the egg was released from, the cells there luteinize and are able to then produce progesterone. And in some patients with hyperprolactinemia, the corpus luteum doesn't produce enough progesterone, probably as a result of the hyperprolactinemia. We're not really sure. And patients can have a variation in the luteal phase of their menstrual cycle. Sometimes it can be shortened or sometimes prolonged. In a normal person, the luteal phase is usually going to be about 14 days after an egg is released. And gynecologists can do biopsies of the endometrial lining in the second half of a menstrual cycle and compare those biopsy findings with normative histopathology, or histology, I should say, from groups of women who have normal menstrual periods, and then determine whether or not there is a defect in the luteal phase. And interestingly, patients with hyperprolactinemia, even though they may have, quote, regular, unquote, menses occurring nearly monthly, they may have a luteal phase defect, and that corpus luteum doesn't produce enough progesterone, and the lack of progesterone can cause failure of implantation and infertility. That's perhaps an oversimplification. I've tried to explain it as I would to any one of my patients. But luteal phase defect is one of the causes of infertility in people with hyperprolactinemia who have mild to modest hyperprolactinemia and menses that are slightly irregular. Obviously, if a woman is not having menses at all, she's not ovulating, because the hyperprolactinemia has affected the hypothalamic pituitary unit and led to discoordinated FSH and LH release and lack of ovarian stimulation. As I mentioned, some women will have some ovarian stimulation, but they won't get the LH surge and ovulate, and then they'll have breakthrough bleeding as they get ulcerations or breakdown in the thickened endometrial lining. The bottom line is that all of this can lead to infertility.
So that's where treatment comes in, and I presume giving a dopamine agonist drug like bromocriptine or cabergoline can restore fertility to normal.
Yes, Jorge, that's indeed the case, and restoration of fertility to normal is indeed possible in most patients. Some of the earlier literature indicates that fertility is restored in 90 to 95% of persons treated with this drug, whether you're a man or a woman. In regards to women and fertility, it's important to keep in mind that the older you become, the less fertile you are. So a woman who's 35 years old, for example, probably has a fertility rate of about 70%. And what that means is that unprotected intercourse over the course of a year with attempts to try to achieve pregnancy, she'll achieve pregnancy. 70% of women will achieve pregnancy under those circumstances. The younger you are, the greater your fertility rate. The older, the less that fertility rate. And restoration of prolactin to normal simply returns you to the fertility rate for your age, assuming there are no other disease processes that diminish that fertility rate for you as an individual person.
Do you have a particular goal or some level you like to achieve with the prolactin?
Well, there's sort of a goal of normalization of the prolactin is the first order of business, but I actually like to see them somewhere between 10 and 15 in a lady who's trying to achieve pregnancy. There's actually less fertility in patients who have hyperprolactinemia and or take medical therapy and have prolactin levels under 5. One study said under 10. I don't like to aim to have it that low in women who are trying to achieve pregnancy. I don't care if it goes that low in someone who's not interested in pregnancy. In fact, the more suppression of the tumor and the hyperprolactinemia, the better, unless you're trying to get pregnant, and I'll aim for 10 to 15.
So what advice do you give your patients?
My immediate response to your question is to have faith and to recognize that sometimes it takes a few months to establish fertility. In fact, I like for patients to wait a few months before they try to get pregnant, because once we have their prolactin normalized, it may take a few months for their menstrual periods to straighten out. And it's important, I think, to know the cycle length. What's your new cycle length going to be with your tumor and on therapy? And once you've established your cycle length for a few months, then you know when to start doing pregnancy tests if you're late. So, for example, if your cycle is going to be 32 days, then you know if you're 36 to 38 days on a particular cycle after you're starting treatment and trying to get pregnant, you know it's time to get a pregnancy test. So it's important to establish that, especially when you have a disease process that can affect your menstrual cycle. Now, I've had patients who get pregnant. They say, oh, I never got my periods back, but here I am 3 months pregnant. So they got pregnant on the first cycle after normalization of prolactin. And I've seen other patients, it takes a while to achieve that pregnancy after we normalize their prolactin level.
You and I were discussing, I think, a few months back, and I learned the estrogen can fuel the growth of prolactinomas, and I know that estrogens are produced in high amounts during pregnancy. So what do you tell patients that have prolactinomas that become pregnant?
That's a very good question, Jorge, and it's a difficult and complex answer. The first thing is that we base what we tell patients on individual circumstances, so that some of what we say depends on the size of the tumor and the magnitude of the hyperprolactinemia and the age of the patient, for example. And then secondly, we talk about the medication, follow-up during pregnancy, and the potential future need to restart medication during pregnancy. In regards to your comment about the possibility of these tumors increasing in size during pregnancy, that has been established. It doesn't happen in everybody, and I've certainly seen patients where their tumors did not increase in size at all during pregnancy. But there's an old paper, and what I tell people's data from that paper, I think, is if you look at microadenomas, about 15% of them will increase in size during pregnancy, and 5% of women will get into trouble from that. For the macroadenomas, about 33 or 35% or so, I don't remember the figure, will increase in size during pregnancy, and about 15% of people will get into trouble. And what I mean by get into trouble is have tumor growth that causes headaches or maybe visual compromise because of the tumor involving the visual pathways, or develop one or more anterior pituitary hormone deficiencies that require treatment. The problem here, of course, is that when a patient achieves pregnancy, we usually stop the dopamine agonist drug. And the reason we do that is because these drugs have not been formally studied in pregnant women, which are one of the protected classes in clinical research. There are, however, thousands of women who've been treated with dopamine agonist drugs, either bromocriptine or cabergoline, during pregnancy and have been collated and studied and reported. And what we do know is that there do not seem to be problems with treatment during pregnancy. For example, the fetal malformation rate is normal, which is about 2 to 3.5% of pregnancies anyway. The miscarriage rate is normal, which is about 15% of pregnancies. And when they've studied the children born of mothers who took dopamine agonist drugs while they were pregnant, there have not been any neurological problems or learning disabilities or any other issues to be concerned about. So we stop the drug when a lady becomes pregnant, and then if we have problems that were discussed earlier, we restart therapy during pregnancy. Sometimes we do so without the benefit of an MRI. You can follow prolactin levels and see whether or not there might be tumor expansion during pregnancy.
Well, tell us about that. what happens to prolactin during normal pregnancy, and what happens to the levels of a patient that has a pituitary tumor?
Well, in a normal pregnancy in a woman without a prolactinoma, prolactin levels actually do increase with time and duration of pregnancy. And by the third trimester, they can be as high as 120, with normal being under 20, but as high as 120 in normal women. And this is due to the estrogen-induced hyperplasia or proliferation of the prolactin-producing cells in the pituitary in attempt to prepare the breast to breastfeed after delivery. In patients with pituitary adenomas, interestingly, and there was an old study about this, and I've seen it in my patients, most of the increase in prolactin that you see is going to take place in the first half of the pregnancy, and then levels seem to sort of stabilize. So if I see a prolactin level that's increasing dramatically throughout the pregnancy, that's a sign to me that the tumor is increasing in size and might ultimately become a problem. So we start surveying patients more closely. You know, we might send them for visual field analysis, or if they're having headaches, put them in an MRI scanner and take a look just to see if there's a problem. When I was in my training, we sent everyone for visual field studies at regular intervals throughout pregnancy, but I tend not to do that any longer because you usually get a normal report, and I think it's wasteful. Most people who are going to have abnormal visual fields are going to have headaches first, and you'll see a sign that tumor is progressing by following the prolactin. So I like to look at prolactin levels every 6 weeks during pregnancy, and I'll get alarmed if I see it starting to get much higher than 300 to 400 during a pregnancy.
So if prolactin levels are supposed to be elevated in a normal pregnancy to prepare for breastfeeding and you have to restart the medication, what's your target? How do you know you're achieved the you achieved adequate control over the tumor in the setting of a pregnancy?
That's an excellent and insightful question, Jorge. And generally, we just aim to get the prolactin level to what should be normal for pregnancy. So around 100 is usually pretty good for most people. This also allows the hyperprolactinemia to do its job on breast tissue, so that the lady can breastfeed after she delivers her child. Another thing that I would say is that I think trying to treat to normalization will probably cause some problems with breastfeeding after delivery. So I tend not to like to normalize that prolactin in that stage of the postpartum period either. In fact, women who do not require dopamine agonist drugs to be restarted during pregnancy, I usually keep them off therapy during the period of breastfeeding. I tend to want to see an MRI at about 8 weeks postpartum just to make sure we're not dealing with tumor growth problems, but I'll let them run hyperprolactinemic because that's normal physiology after delivery anyways, at least for probably about 2 to 3 months. And then after that period of time, most women who are normal would have normal prolactin levels between episodes of breastfeeding, with prolactin levels that spike as a consequence of the neural feedback arcs and reflexes that lead to hyperprolactinemia during nipple stimulation of suckling.
How about when breastfeeding is complete? What are your next steps? What do you do when a patient stops breastfeeding?
At that point, I intensify therapy and go ahead and stick to the goal of trying to normalize the prolactin level. Some women after delivery want to take oral contraceptives, and that's fine. However, those are estrogens, so I recommend they use the low-dose estrogen preparations. And we simply follow the prolactin level and adjust the dose of the dopamine agonist drug to keep the hyperprolactinemia under control.
Well, as usual, this has been very interesting and informative, and I'm sure our audience will feel the same way. Are there any other or any final thoughts you'd want to share with patients that might be going through a pregnancy?
I think one of the matters that's often overlooked in women who are pregnant with a prolactinoma is that they may have tumor growth that compromises pituitary function and can lead to, you know, hypoadrenalism, which can lead to problems with labor and delivery or cesarean section if they can't make appropriate ACTH-derived cortisol production in response to the stress of labor delivery or cesarean section, for example. And also patients may have mild central hypothyroidism, which can lead to problems with fetal development if it's early in the stage of the development process, say before 17 weeks of gestational age, or excessive amounts of amniotic fluid later in pregnancy and hypothyroid babies, for example. So it's critical that if you have a prolactinoma and you're going through pregnancy, to work with your physician, especially if you have a macroadenoma, work with your physician to ensure that your pituitary functions remain normal during pregnancy, and if not, that you are treated appropriately to ensure that you and your baby have a good outcome.
Well, thank you, Dr. Blevins, for sharing all this great information.
You're very welcome. Thank you for this opportunity. It's always a pleasure to share information derived from my readings and my experience with others so that they can take better care of themselves and educate those who are also involved in their health care. Have a wonderful day.
You have been listening to another exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. Thank you for listening.